Graduation is a sweet occasion, but finding the perfect gift can be a bitter struggle. MMS.com has a solution. Personalized M&Ms. Just imagine the look on your grad's face when they receive a custom candy creation featuring their school's colors, name, and even their photo printed right on some M&Ms. It's a thoughtful way to celebrate their accomplishments and make the occasion even more special. Visit MMS.com to create your own personalized gifts and party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code WONDERY to receive 15% off your next order.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code WONDERY for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1045. Thank you so much if you came out to Helium in Philly or to the Funny Bone in Columbus. The Wizard Guitar Tour has been really fun so far, and it seems like people are also excited to see the actual Wizard guitar, so I will be bringing it to the Punchline in San Francisco, Feb 27 through 29, March 5 through 7 at the Punchline in Sacramento, then March 21st at the Brea Improv in California, and then March 26th through 28th at Helium in Portland. And then there's a bunch of other dates after that, so if you go to id10t.com/tour, you can get tickets and info on that. I hope to see you there. But let's talk about the ID10T Community Corkboard, events at id10t.com. Riley writes, "My name is Riley Peterson, and I released a 6-song EP last year about the trials and tribulations of a rather unconventional storybook relationship. It's what I like to call sad boy coffeehouse music, influenced by John Mayer, Julian Baker, Frank Turner, and Scott Hutchinson. I haven't done much to get it out there, but it's something I'm proud of and love to share with all of you. It's available on all streaming platforms under Riley Peterson." That's Peterson with an E-N, Peterson. "Genuinely hope you enjoy." Riley, that's fantastic. I hope we can generate some more downloads and listens and activity, and I hope you get to tour. So that is really, really, really well done. Congratulations on completing that. And again, if you've completed your thing or someone else's thing that you want to promote, events at id10t.com. This episode is Jesse Tyler Ferguson, who we had met in passing several times over the years, but had never really sat down and had a conversation, and he was an absolute delight. I mean, I'm so excited for his upcoming Extreme Makeover, which is premiering February 16th. It is on HGTV. And if you were an Extreme Home Makeover fan, then I think you would probably be excited too. And he's just such an empathetic and compassionate guy. And that is what this show needs. So I am so glad that he is taking up the helm over at Extreme Makeover. So Feb 16, we will keep an eye on that. That's coming up soon. And then also the last season of Modern Family, which is now on ABC Wednesdays at 9 p.m. At the recording of this podcast, I don't think they had shot all the episodes, but they might have by now. So isn't that crazy? 11 seasons of Modern Family. Congratulations to Jesse and to everyone in the cast of that show, who all seem just lovely. And the other fun thing is that Jesse and I traded Pops. We both had Pop toys, and we signed them and traded them. It's a fun kind of nerdy thing to do. So thank you to Jesse. Your Pop toy is now... I have a big like AT-AT bookshelf in my office, and then there's a bunch of classic ones on there. There's a couple of Lucy Ricardo ones on there, and now you have joined the Pop Television Hall of Fame in my office. So thanks for the pop, Jesse, and now let us begin the ID10T podcast number 1045 with Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
We'll be right back.
room was not, this room was a cavity in the house. And the previous owner said, oh, there's a cavity in the house. This was a concrete wall. And he said, there's a cavity.
This was just like
there was nothing. I posted a whole bunch of Instagram stories on it. And so you can see it go from, and it's on my profile, you can see it go from a wall to they jackhammered through a little hole. And you can see there's like, you know, 7 feet of dirt and construction garbage from 100 years ago. And then we dug it out and then turned it into a room.
That's insane.
Yeah, because it's all concrete, so I thought it would be a good, you know, like a good soundproof room.
Or like a bunker.
Or a bunker.
When the time comes.
Yeah. Or a...
a fallout shelter.
Or a secret amateur taxidermy room.
Right? Yeah. Like, all those are great.
Squirrel pelts.
Should we turn the podcast room into a taxidermy room?
It could do double duty.
Yeah,
we could turn it into amateur taxidermy and also into a podcast room. But I don't know why only recently... Because you've been scheduled to do the podcast for quite a while, and we were on vacation over the holidays, and you know, we just had the HGTV app on because I have a little Roku stick. So we take it to all the hotels we're in so we can watch all of our stuff.
Smart.
The HGTV app was on, and a commercial for Extreme Makeover Home Edition came on. I was like, is that Jess? Are you hosting?
Yeah.
And you are.
Yeah.
You're hosting one of the greatest renovation shows in the history of television. That's insane.
I know.
How did that...
Wait, are we going?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Now that we're talking about the show, we should just launch into it. How did you get involved with this show?
It is crazy that I'm the host. It's sort of like, throughout the entire process, it was like a two-month process. We did 10 episodes over the course of, I guess about 10 weeks. And every day I would wake up and be like, I cannot believe that they've trusted me to be the host of this like pretty valuable property.
Oh my God, it's iconic.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't fully know how I ended up being asked. And I remember sitting down with some of the executives because it was just an email that came in saying, we're interested in Jesse doing this. And I have been approached to do other reality TV, but it never felt right. I'm a pretty active cook in the kitchen. And so, you know, Food Network had come up to me with a few ideas, and nothing seemed like something I wanted to spend my time doing. And you know, I'm an activist. I love I love humanitarian work. And so when this came to me, I was like, this is sort of like, I appreciate design, I appreciate renovation, I think it's exciting, but also that aspect of getting to meet people who need something and be able to give them that thing that they need is like, what a gift.
Oh, you're a dream genie. Like, you just get to come in and, like, wave over. I mean,
truly.
I know there's a lot of work, but in theory, just sort
but
of like,
I am,
wave a wand and, like, make someone's life
I am
better.
The person who gets to sort of show up first and be like, we're going to do this for you. And then I sort of step aside and let, like, the professionals actually do the work. And then I get to come in and be like, let's look at this stuff together. It's really the front – it's a front row seat to, like – the best of humankind.
As you probably know, having worked in the business for a long time, a lot of jobs come with like you're generally sort of weighing the balance between upside and downside. And if the upside outweighs the downside, then you tend to agree to do stuff. There's literally no downside to this job.
I mean, the downsides are literally the heat and like, you know, when you're just like physically tired and you're building a home, but like you know, I don't get involved with that too much, but like literally we were working in the hottest part of the summer in the hottest areas of California. So that was like the one downside. But, you know, all of that work is being put into this family and these families that really need something. And the stories that we found, these families that we found to help are just really remarkable. And I know the show is, you know, was on television for, I think 9 years. Mm-hmm. And I know we're sort of picking up where they left off, but it really is a reboot. It really is. It feels like a first season of a show. And so I was really impressed with the families that they found in this first season. It's a really strong group of stories that we get to tell.
Yeah. And that's really what it is. It's a story. It's a family story that is, for lack of a better word, housed in a renovation show. Yeah. Like it's, The renovation is the reason to meet these people.
Right.
But it's really just about who are they, you know, like what's going on in their lives, how can we make their lives better. And I think in a world of completely toxic news cycles, people not only crave but like need this kind of programming.
Absolutely.
To just as a beam of hope, like, oh, there's good things in the world, there are people doing good things in the world.
It feels like it's coming back at the right time, and you really hit the nail on the head with that. While we were doing this project, you know, every day we came in, we're like, there's so much bad happening in the world right now, and there's so much negative news. To be able to start our day doing so much positivity and working with people who are there to help this family and these people who are in desperate need of like a fresh start, it was just really moving and poignant. And it really makes the borders of this whole world feel like they're closer. Really, mm-hmm. I felt so much more connected to mankind and humanity. And, you know, I mean, I spent the last 11 years of my life on a very successful sitcom, and my life changed when I did Modern Family, and there's a lot that changed within my own bubble. And like I you know, before Modern Family started, I was just a theater actor. I loved like getting to know people, I love making human connections, and with the show I love meeting my fans, but there's also sometimes a hesitance to like really getting to know someone, because I'm always questioning like, what do they want from me?
Sure.
And there is a bit of like, there's a bit of work sometimes that people have to do to get inside with me. Like, you know, I mean, I love meeting people, but like I maybe will hold them a bit at arm's length. And this show also gave me the opportunity to let my guard down and to really let people come in and touch me, which I really appreciate.
That's good. And again, it only takes a couple of sour friendships it's like if someone shits in the pool, you don't go, well, they shit in the pool over there.
Yeah.
It's like, no, the whole pool is like everyone gets out of the
analogy.
Pool. And so it, of course you're going to be protective, because there are, you know, a handful of assholes ruin everything for everyone all the time. This is why we have locks on our doors. This is why we have two-factor authentication. This is why, you know, people who are in your position might need to keep people at arm's length a little bit, because there are a few, not everyone, but if it only happens once or twice, that's enough to like put some shields up to make sure that people aren't trying to take advantage of you.
Yeah. And then I was given this job where like literally my job is to let people in.
Yeah.
And to get to know people's stories and to really ask questions and to like let them show their emotions to me in ways that I haven't really done with strangers in a very long time. And there's something really powerful about that. And it makes me want to, you know, meet more people like that, and also just be more open to, you know, my fellow mankind. You know, I think it really closed, it opened up a lot of like windows in my own soul, I think.
Yeah. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like that those types of human connection also fuel your passion for activism, I would imagine.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the activist trail can be a very rocky one, because mm-hmm. you're fighting so hard to make sure that everyone has rights, to make sure that everyone feels protected, to make sure that everyone feels equal. And I'm sure there are some days where you're like, God damn it, it just, come on.
Yeah.
And so is it a true statement to say that this kind of thing really helps you go, okay, I feel refreshed, I feel renewed, I feel faith in humanity?
Well, I mean, and I think anyone who does humanitarian work and activism, it's a long process. And like there are, you take 3 steps forward, you take, you know, 5 steps back. And that's just part of what it is. The great thing about Extreme Makeover Home Edition is like I'm working with this amazing infrastructure, and they are going to build a home in 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to reveal that home to that family in 5 days. And it's just going to happen. So you know at the end of that 5 days that we have something to show for it. And like it just feels like such forward momentum the entire time. We are doing good things for people, and it's happening quickly. And it's just, it's very gratifying. It's like you're on a train of goodwill that's just like chugging through these 10 episodes. And like, it's really very special.
Please forgive me for relating this to an experience of mine, but I just want to, I feel like I want to connect with you on this, but I host a show on NBC called The Wall.
Yeah.
And The Wall is basically, I just thought it was going to be like, oh, it'd be like a fun, flashy game show.
Yeah.
And then I realized for me, that show is almost like a podcast. Like I'm getting to know people who are really good people who've sacrificed a lot, mm-hmm. who like deserve some wins in their lives because they've spent much of their life sacrificing for other people. And when people say, what's it like to host that show? I feel like I'm trying to learn from these people and just absorb their goodness and be near it and be in awe of it, because it does every episode just like re-energizes my faith in humanity. Like, oh, there are good people in the world. There are good. And it just feels good to be near that.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I mean, it's and I've watched the show and you're absolutely right. Your show does do that. And it's, you know, I think it's, what I'm looking to do with Extreme Makeover is just close those gaps between people. I mean, I feel like there's such separation. A lot of it has to do with financial situations or just proximity and, the cards that we were dealt. But at the end of the day, we're all part of the human race and we all have trials and tribulations and we all have, hurdles to overcome, and certain hurdles are easier than others. And if you can help someone with those hurdles when you have a little bit of downtime of your own, I think that's just a really good thing. I mean, I think it's taught me that being a good person is free, and being it costs nothing to be good, and it costs nothing to give back. With a friendly voice or like an ear to hear someone's problems. I mean, that's all free. Granted, building the homes themselves are not free, and I like to thank Masonite and Home Depot and all the people who like helped us build these homes and like the builders who gave their time. But you know, the act of being good is free, and it's such an easy thing to give.
Yeah, and also the importance of being in front of people on a human level, because especially when you're online, there's a layer of human separation because you're essentially just interfacing with text.
Right.
And it's easy to forget that there are humans on the other side of that text, on the other side of their machine.
Absolutely.
And so the idea that I feel like we have evolved to need to connect with other people in real life and look in their eyes and shake their hands and see them and understand them more than just via text. And so when we're kind of dealing with big ticket issues online, it can feel very this or that as opposed to human.
Yeah.
And being able to sit down with people and just talk and experience and understand them, I feel like it's just so important. So it's so good to have a job that kind of puts you in that position where it's like, that's part of your job, to go connect with people.
I know. It's truly a blessing. I mean, I can't believe I get to do it. And to go back to your original question, is how did I get this job? I fully don't know. Ty Pennington, who hosted the show on its first run, is a fantastic carpenter. He's a terribly charismatic person. He was the heartbeat of that show. And so, you know, I was thinking, like, how are people going to move on from him? And the designers of that original show. And it's hard, but I think, you know, the show is now living on HGTV, which I think is the perfect place for it to live. And it is told through the lens of what HGTV does. And I think with that, they really wanted a fresh take on who's going to be the face of the show. And I think over the course of my 11 years in the public eye, I have proven myself to be a somewhat, you know, compassionate person who can also bring humor to a sometimes tricky situation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I'm meant to do. And I have certainly gotten my hands dirty in the first season of the show. And I am welding things and picking up nail guns and helping, you know, erect walls. And it's very exciting. I mean, it's a world that I'm not familiar with, which I think is also sort of the fish out of water aspect of it, I think is also interesting. So I think that's sort of why I was given this job. And I just trusted that the people who made that decision were smarter than I was and knew that I'd be the right person for it. So
did I read correctly that you go to Catholic school? You did. So, okay. So
12 years.
Yeah. Okay. So I went to all boys Catholic high school.
Okay.
Two different ones, 'cause my family moved from Denver to Los Angeles. But did, when you're on a show like Modern Family, which is rarefied television air.
Yeah.
Shows just don't, I mean, I feel like Modern Family, a couple shows like Big Bang and Modern Family, I feel like just slid in under the wire. It's just like Indiana Jones grabbing his hat as the wall drops.
For network television.
For network television sitcoms, you know, like that kind of mega sitcom hit. This is where I'm going with this. Did you ever feel, and maybe you didn't, but did you ever feel any of that sort of like weird Catholic guilt of like, this is too much success? Is it okay for me to be on this show?
I was never a very good Catholic, no.
Okay, good.
No, I mean, listen, I worked very hard before Modern Family, and I paid my dues doing theater and babysitting on the side to, like, make ends meet. And I feel like I earned it. And
good,
I
good. That's a healthier attitude.
Yeah. I mean, I feel very blessed. I'd certainly acknowledge it. I don't feel like, you know, it was – I deserved it by any means. I don't feel like
– you mean entitled.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes, of course. But I don't feel Catholic guilt around it because I do think something that me and my husband, Justin, have done is, like, taken that platform that we have now and tried to give back
as
much as we can. And I think, you know – this parlaying into Extreme Makeover is a perfect example of, like, taking that platform and being able to do something good with it.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, like I said, I was a terrible Catholic, so I don't feel bad about that.
Yeah. I feel like I wasn't a great Catholic either, but I also feel like there were some things that were instilled at a molecular level, like, never, you know, oh, things are going well. You should feel bad about that.
I've never gotten the Catholic guilt.
Oh, God, you're so lucky.
I know.
That's
I know.
So good.
Yeah.
I also read that you grew up in New Mexico, and so where is New Mexico on same-sex marriage now? Because it seemed like the rules were not defined, and right. So what does that mean? Can same-sex couples get married there?
Yes.
Okay,
we have marriage equality in all 50 states now, which is very, very exciting. And that started with the overturn of Prop 8 in mm-hmm. California, and then sort of there from there it steamrolled. I mean, I think that the LGBT community in terms of equality is always being challenged. I think there's always danger of things being taken away again. There are certainly places in the United States where you can be married to a same-sex couple could be married on a Friday, and by Monday that couple could lose their job for being married to the person that they love. Fortunately, that's not the case in New Mexico. Actually, New Mexico's sort of has a bit of a blue wave situation going right now.
Okay.
And it's since the time I left there in 1994. Mm-hmm. It's become much more progressive, and I go back to visit all the time, and I feel very comfortable there. I've met with a lot of the LGBTQ community in Albuquerque, and we worked with marriage equality, me and my husband there through our foundation, Tie the Knot. My Catholic school still, I don't think they have a gay straight alliance, which I'm kind of bummed out about. But you know, I think, you know, small steps.
Yeah. My high school Latin teacher, I loved, and we reconnected not that long ago. And he went to a different church. Like, mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was, I can't remember which other denomination it was. He was like, I came out, I went to another church, I'm married to a man that I love. Amazing. And I was so excited for him because I feel like how many people may not have embraced that and been able to feel comfortable like being who they are. And he did. He found a way to make it work. And I was so happy for him.
No, there has been a lot. I mean, I think, you know, when there's constant attack of a minority group, you always look at the negative. But I mean, if we really look back at these past 20 years, there's been so much forward momentum as well. So
good.
I'll try and live in that a little bit more.
And Albuquerque is it really like a hotbed of acting? Like, how do you go from Albuquerque to, like, I'm going to break out and I'm going to go?
I mean, I was a rare bird. I mean, Neil Patrick Harris is from Albuquerque.
Yeah.
John Cameron Mitchell, who is the creator of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, is from Albuquerque. There's a few people, Freddie Prinze Jr., I believe. There's a few of us who broke out of Albuquerque.
But they came out really young. Like, Neil was, like, little kid actor.
Absolutely. Neil came back to Albuquerque after doing, like, Clara's Heart and Doogie Howser, and we would audition for the community theater together. And who do you think they chose to play John Darling and Peter Pan? It wasn't Jesse Tyler Ferguson. No.
The other three-named boy.
Yeah, I lost a lot of community theater roles to Neil Patrick Harris. We're actually friends now, which is...
I've lost a lot of Disney memorabilia to Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh my gosh, of course you have.
Yeah,
he's a fanatic.
He's amazing. He and David, well, when he lived in LA, they did these astonishingly amazing Halloween parties and birthday parties.
Yep.
And, you know, because Neil is a circus fan and a magic fan and a Muppet fan. And you know, their house is just a shrine to all these amazing things. And their kids are so lucky
their
to have them.
Their kids are so lucky. Harper and Gideon are like the luckiest children ever. And they're such great parents.
The best.
I definitely look up to them as they're role models of mine and good friends as well.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment.
Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
But breaking out of Albuquerque was – I never had any doubt in my mind that I wanted to go to New York and be on Broadway. I had never been to New York or seen Broadway. And when I was in high school, I had the opportunity to spend a month in France on an exchange program. We had hosted a French student to our house the summer before. And it was – this coming up summer was then my turn to go to France and spend – a month in France. And I could either do that or I could spend 5 days in New York with the local community theater trip, which is basically blue hairs, blue hair women. And I decided to tag along with these old ladies and go see, you know, 8 shows in 5 days in New York City instead of going to France for a month.
Oh, wow.
Because it was the same price. My parents were like, you have to choose one or the other. I was like, I have to go to New York. I have to see what Broadway is. And the minute I landed in New York, I just felt immediately like I was at home in a weird way that, like, you would not expect for someone who lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to feel at home on the streets of New York City. I mean, it's so different, but I think I was just meant to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was never a question in my mind. I came back from that trip and I said, I'm going to New York for school. I don't care how I get there, but I have to figure out a way to study there. And I auditioned for some different schools and a lot of places I couldn't afford to go to. And I ended up going to the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, where they give you a certificate of completion after 2 years. So I would say I didn't take college.
Right.
I didn't take college, but I have a certificate,
yeah.
of completion.
Yeah, that's all that matters.
I think a pretty great career to show for it too. So I never second-guessed the fact that I would be in New York.
Yeah, that's a really fortunate thing to – because – you know, I remember the first time I actually hung out with other comedians, like people who were actually – like when I was in college, there was a club of people who wanted to be comedians. And as soon as I got around them, I was like, oh, I'm not weird.
Yeah, yeah.
This is just a thing.
Absolutely.
Like there's just – I'm just – this is my tribe of people and I just needed to find them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I always feel – and fortunately, the internet – that is the one positive thing about the internet, is it helped people connect with
absolutely.
Their tribes.
Absolutely.
And so, but that.
But back in the day, we had to take trains, planes, and automobiles to find them.
Analog connection.
Yeah,
it was an analog connection.
Yeah.
it was a coax cable. But but that idea of being able to be fortunate enough to sort of land and feel like, oh, I'm connected to this space, and I always feel bad for people who maybe have that yearn or the desire, or they feel out of place or displaced or something, and they can't quite put their finger on it, and maybe they just don't have the opportunity to, you know, like land in their tribe somehow.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I have a lot of kids who contact me on social media, you know, most of them from the LGBTQ community, saying, "Yeah, I feel very isolated where I'm at." And like, how did you find your people? And I had the good fortune of being able to go to school in New York and find my people. And you know, I just encourage people to and the internet is such a great tool, and I encourage people to remember that the world is that the borders of their world are bigger than their hometown, and there are people out there who are waiting for them with open arms.
Yeah, I have a friend who has a 19-year-old sister, and she was out visiting for the holidays, and this girl's kind of quiet, but I can tell she's funny.
Yeah.
Like I can just like comedians can just sense other comedians. And I said to my friend, like, you should tell her to take an improv. Like, just see if that resonates with her.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like it was I didn't want to be like, oh, you should take an improv. Get the fuck out of my face, weirdo.
Yeah.
But I just sort of felt like, oh, I feel like if you just get her near some comedy people, because she was saying to her older sister, who's closer to my age, like, I don't know. I just feel weird. I don't feel like I connect with other people in college. And I'm like,
you're like comedian.
Get around comedians, you know? And so, I, like, in as much as we as adults can kind of tell younger people, like, oh, you're not weird.
Yeah.
You feel out of place because you're in a weird circumstance.
Yeah.
But you just need to find your people. And if you do that, you're going to feel so rooted.
Yeah. Most creative people have that history, though, I find. You know, all the great writers I know and comedians and actors are always like, I was always the outsider. I was always the one who, like, people thought was weird.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, when you're young, you are trying so hard to fit in with everyone around you and be invisible and, like, not stand out. And you don't want to be picked on. And then, like, all those things that make you weird and quirky are the things that we want as adults. We want to stand out. We want things that make us special so we can excel in our careers. And, like, we want to be desirable to certain people. And what makes you desirable is uniqueness. And mm-hmm. So, like, it's that weird balance of, like, trying not to kill those seeds of brilliance when people are early in their early years, because they're trying to, like, blend in. And I definitely remember trying to blend in, but also knowing that there was something special that I had to offer.
Yeah, those nuggets of, quote, weirdness are what give you your voice.
Yeah.
And those are the things that are sort of antithetical to the sort of traditional, especially high school social circles, mm-hmm. where all those kids are just trying to fit in and trying to be cool. And I feel like the creatives, what sort of fuels that is this sort of the blessing and the curse of introspection, mm-hmm. which is, I believe, a gift, but also can really get in your way if you're trying to just navigate the world sometimes. And so it's trying to find that balance between, like, you know, like keeping the voice from being destructive, but also using it to sort of realize, as you said, that it's like, that's your uniqueness, you know? And I just don't know how to, like, how do you tell kids that? Oh, if you feel weird, that's okay. That's okay. Like, that's,
I remember people telling me that when I was
young.
It just doesn't connect.
Yeah.
Because in the moment, you know, I was being bullied and I was, you know, I didn't want to go to school because I was kind of nervous about, you know, having interactions with people. And, like, that trumps embracing your weirdness, you know, at that time. So it's a tricky balance. I mean, sometimes I look back and I'm like, God, it's a miracle any of us got out of the hometowns that we were in.
Totally. But I also, and, you know, not that by any stretch of the imagination it's good to be bullied or it's good to feel like an outsider, but the fact that you took those experiences and the way that you express that is like, well, I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that mm-hmm. everyone feels
right.
Okay.
Right.
And so I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna be an activist. I'm gonna make people feel, you know, seen and heard, and, you know, so at least you were able to do something positive with that, which has, I'm sure, dramatically affected thousands, if not like hundreds of thousands or millions of people with the work that you do. So at least you're able to say. At least you're able to do something good with it. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel tremendous amount of sadness and empathy for people who don't know how to, or just don't, for whatever reason, have the set of circumstances or the skill sets into being able to do something with that, you know? So what advice do you have for people who feel kind of trapped in that zone?
Fuck. Yeah, I mean, it's, I feel like the first thing to do is find that tribe of people that you feel you can connect with. And sometimes that's a sibling. Sometimes that's, you know, the other weird kids at school. Sometimes it's, you know, it's going online and finding that group of people that sort of think like you. And we all have passions, and, like, you know, sometimes we're afraid to talk about what our passions are because we think that they're not worthy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that anything that's, like, something that you're excited about is something that's worth giving back to the world. And it's that weird balance of, like, navigating childhood, but also, you know, starting to look toward the future and, like, what impact do you want to make in the world? And, like, I know I always think about role models. I think role models are a great place to start. Like, who inspires you? Who do you get excited by? And, like, what do they do that inspires you? Why do they inspire you? And, like, how could you follow that person's path and try and make a mark in the world in the same way?
I this is sort of a weird leap to make, but it's one of the reasons why I love Rocket Man so much.
Okay.
Because here you have this guy where you look at him, you go, oh my God, how could he not be the happiest person in the world? He's
Rocket Man.
He's Rocket Man, you know? He's fucking Rocket Man. Like, you know, just that fact of, you know, 25% in the 70s, it was something like 25% of income in the music industry was, I think that's right, was funneling to Elton John, or like he was responsible for 25.
Yeah.
And, you know, couldn't pull himself out of his bedroom because he was just so eaten alive by personal demons. And so just kind of knowing that, that it's, you know, no path is without challenge,
right?
But, you know, it's still achievable and right. still conquerable, I think right. is a really, I don't know, it's just, to me, it just, it should help people feel, and also to not be afraid to, like, to know that if you try something, it doesn't have to be your permanent thing forever. Exactly. If you find a group, you can try it for a while, and if it doesn't suit you, right. then you can move on to a different one. It doesn't have to be like, yeah. this is my permanent thing forever.
Right, and like you just said, I think it's so important that nothing comes easy. I think, you know, when things are hard and when things don't seem to be coming as quickly as they should, that's not a sign that it's not something you should be doing. I mean, I think about like my acting career. Like if I have listened to those sets of rules, I would not be acting because it took me a while before I got a big break. So. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen, I've talked about it a bit on the podcast because I was blown away by it, but Michelle Monaghan told me about this documentary called The Biggest Little Farm.
I haven't seen it, no.
It's mind blowing. It basically, you know, this isn't ruining too much, but it's big about a couple who, you know, they live in Santa Monica and they just decide like, let's see if we can start a sustainable farm. They have no farming experience whatsoever. And it's just this like 7-year journey that they, and the guy just by coincidence happens to be like a nature documentarian. So it's shot stunningly.
Uh-huh.
And they basically just, you watch this 7-year journey of them building this farm that ultimately creates this ecosystem. And they build it. There's like nothing on the property. It's fucking dirt. It's like unusable dirt, and they build this from nothing, and it's so wonderful to see their process, like you said, you know, 3 steps forward, 5 steps back, and it's how they sort of almost kind of stoically embrace all of their challenges. Like every time something good happens, it's followed by a oh god damn it. And how they kind of take these situations and figure out how to fold them in and use them, like use negative situations to their benefit.
Right.
And it's, even if you don't give a shit about farming, it is such a wonderful like life movie because it's incredibly affirming.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so what types of challenges do you feel like you've seen over the years that you've gone, you know what, this sucks, but rather than, you know, try to punch through it, I'm gonna try to use it for good, or I'm gonna try to use it to my benefit.
Oh gosh. I mean, I've been involved in projects that I don't believe in, that I don't like doing. Like I don't enjoy being an actor when I'm doing them. Like I have done them for money, and I have done them because I'm trying to stay relevant and trying to make myself feel like an actor. And at the same time, they're sort of crushing my soul and making me not want to wake up and do what I love doing. And you know, they made me question my ability. They made me question my purpose and like whether or not I should be doing what I'm doing. And I think that coming up against those struggles, I feel like it made me a stronger actor and a stronger person in the long run, because it challenged me to stay in it and to sort of see it through those uncomfortable times and, remind myself that my instincts are good. And the reason I'm doing this is because I am good at it. And I think investing in yourself is the most important thing you can do. And it forced me to invest in myself in ways that I have never had to invest in myself. Because nothing's worse than putting something out in the world that you're not fully proud of.
Mm-hmm. And then having to talk about it.
And then having to talk about it on a podcast.
This thing is great. Yeah, I love exactly. it. Yeah. Oh, God, I'm dying inside. I have emotional diarrhea.
But it is, it's truly a reminder that you have to invest in yourself, and you have to believe in yourself. You have to be your biggest fan.
Wow, that's such a great point, though, because obviously, I don't think anyone should walk out of their house and go, hey, world, punch me in the balls.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you should seek out contentious situations, but, you know, but it's almost like because you embrace the struggle, because you embrace that situation as like, oh, okay, that situation afforded me the opportunity to see what I don't like and to strengthen my own resolve about who I am and what I do. You know, if you hadn't had, because I just think people think everything, you know, like if to be successful means you should just be happy all the time. And you got, you know, it's like Elton John, you got no problem. And that's not at all what life is. No. You do, unfortunately or fortunately, I think kind of fortunately, have to embrace the struggles, because those help, those are where the growth parts happen, you know, and you can hopefully, you know, like share your experience with other people and let them make different mistakes exactly. instead of the same ones that yeah. you might have
yeah,
made.
Yeah, I mean, and like, you know, being in the entertainment business specifically, I'll speak on that just because we both are, like, you know, it's still a job just like any other job is. I mean, you know, doctors have bad days, nurses have bad days, teachers have bad days, and so do artists. I mean, it's not all, you know, joy and celebrity and gifting suites and Emmy Awards and all that stuff. I mean, it's you know, we also have shitty days, and it's a job like any other job, and it just happens to be one that is sometimes widely available on television and streaming.
Oh my God, and streaming too. It's like I keep having this conversation with different people in the business because we're literally the most pivotal point in entertainment history because of how things are shifting, and the next 1 to 3 years are going to be really interesting because who fucking knows?
I know.
Like, what streaming services are going to win out, what television is going to look like.
I remember early on in Modern Family, a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, Leah Delaria, she's like, I just started the show for Netflix. And I was like, oh, in my head, I'm like, oh, I was like, I have to be excited for her, but oh my God, is that what this has come to? She's doing things for Netflix? The DVDs that she put in the mail?
Right.
Oh no. Oh, but Leah, I'm so excited for you. What a wonderful thing. What's it called? It's called Orange is the New Black. Oh God, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Let me know where I can find it.
Good luck with that.
And now it's like, you know, one of the biggest shows.
The cultural touchstone. Yeah.
And also Netflix is like where everyone dreams. It's, you know, now they're winning Oscars. And like, the landscape of television specifically has changed so much in the past 11 years. And I guess the cast of Modern Family is, I guess, maybe lucky to be ejected out into it. I mean, I sort of feel like we're, you know, coming from a different era. Like, we're going to be like one of those time travel movies, like Back to the Future. Like, what the hell is this world that we've been ejected into?
So every week people had to watch it at the same time. That's dumb. Why would anyone fucking do that? Well, also, like, the sitcoms, because I just think about, you know, I think about, like, Seinfeld. Like, they never – obviously, that was a huge show when it was – like, that was the fucking lottery of all lotteries. Obviously, it was a great show, you know, but – in the 90s, it was huge.
Yeah.
Then it was huge on home video.
Yeah.
And now they just made like, I don't know, it was like $500 million because people like watching it on streaming, on Netflix or whatever. Yeah. And so I think the sitcom, and again, I think this also goes to the sort of toxic landscape of the world. People like to check out and just binge watch sitcoms because they're easy to get into. You can drop into any episode. It's escapism. Now there's a nostalgia factor. Yeah. Oh my God. You know, like, I still watch the same, you know, season 2 to season 9 Simpsons episodes all the time.
Absolutely.
I mean, I watch them hundreds of times and I continue to watch. And Modern Family is one of those shows that I feel like for, you know, decades to come, people will always go back and watch that show. It used to be syndication.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's syndicated.
It is,
but also streaming as well. Yeah. So it feels like to me things are gonna be okay on the Jesse Tyler Ferguson front for quite a while, because I just can't imagine like pitching a sitcom now and starting now.
No,
I don't know what that looks like anymore.
No.
What you guys are done now.
We have 4 more episodes to shoot.
To shoot, okay,
and then we're done.
Oh man,
yeah.
Is it like bittersweet? Is it a relief to do new things? It must be all those things.
It's all of those things. I mean, you know, I think back to like when I was a kid, and I think like first grade to 11th grade, and it seemed like an eternity. Mm-hmm. And like now I'm like, that's how long we've been doing Modern Family. And it really puts into perspective how quickly time passes when you're an adult and how fast and how like it's just like sand running through your fingers. You're like, you're trying to hold on to it and make it last a little longer. And you know, we are a family. We're a very tight group of people, and we all like each other a lot, and that's, I think, very rare for a group of people as big as ours after 11 years. And you know, I think, you know, as actors and as artists, you're always looking to do new things, which is exciting, but you know, not seeing these people every day is really something I don't think any of us can wrap our mind around. I wasn't really, when I was shooting Extreme Makeover, I was doing this first season of Extreme Makeover simultaneously as we were shooting the final season of Modern Family. So I was doing double duty for about 2.5 months, and I wasn't able to think about that this was the final season of Modern Family. I really had to put it on the back burner. And the first table read I had after I wrapped Extreme Makeover, I sort of came back and I was sort of able to sort of be more present in the room. And we were reading a draft for a Christmas episode. And I turned the page. I was cold reading. I hadn't had the chance to read the script. And I had a line that said, "Let's just all enjoy each other while we still can."
Oh my gosh.
And I couldn't even – I immediately burst into tears.
Oh my God, of course.
I couldn't finish the line. I had to apologize to the room. We had to like go back 2 pages and like start again. And then I got to the line again. I started crying. That point, everyone's crying in the room.
Of course.
And it really just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I think that's – I think in these next 4 episodes that we're shooting, it's just going to be a lot of that.
But it's a good reminder of – I think that when I was younger, I always used to go – I was used to sort of look at life as like a someday thing. Mm-hmm. And now as I'm getting older, I'm like, no, it's now. Like, yeah, you need to fucking focus on now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's possible I'll be alive in 40 years, yeah, but it's also very likely that I won't be. Uh-huh. And so it just sort of feels like I remember the last 40 years of my life, yeah, you know? So yeah, it's like, you know, you got to enjoy this shit now. There's, yeah, no, you know, it's not, you can't delay it or put it off. You just have to really embrace the, yeah, moment now.
I guess that's a lesson I definitely have learned from these 11 years. And I think that we have done a really good job of not taking any of it for granted as we were doing it. I think we have consistently stopped in the past 11 years and taken stock on where we are. And like, we know that this doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. We know that this is a very rare thing. And we really stop and appreciate that.
That's really nice. Yeah. Is there a thing planned for the like
a final episode?
Yeah, like is there a big?
Oh, guys... I'm sure there'll be a big series wrap party of some sort. And I have no idea. I don't know what they're planning on doing on set. I can only imagine that last day of shooting is going to be wildly emotional as we're wrapping people for the series.
7 years is a long time. I've never lived in one place for 11 years. I've never had, yeah, the same job for 11, yeah, years. Like 11 years is that's a lot.
It's a very long time. It's basically all of my education, like first to 11th grade. Yeah.
Oh my God. That is crazy.
It's insane.
And you're about to graduate.
Yeah.
What kind, yeah, of stuff do you, what do you want to, have you thought about the types of things you want to do moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I always loved doing theater in New York. I did a lot of Broadway before coming out to LA to do television. And so I'm actually going to do a play this summer on Broadway that I love called Take Me Out. That won the Tony Award back in 2003, and they're doing a revival of it. And it's a show I saw back when it was in New York, and I saw it, I think, 3 times because it was so inspiring to me. So the fact that it's now come back into my life in this way and I actually get to be in the play on Broadway is really meaningful. And so I look at those full circle moments in my life and I think I want more of that. You know, I would love to – my first job in New York City was a big Broadway musical, and I got to play one of the leads in it, actually opposite of Lea Delaria from Orange is the New Black. I would love to like go back and do another big Broadway musical. And I'm excited about this Extreme Makeover thing. It's, you know, my career has constantly surprised me, and I have never imagined, I've never been able to dream up these places that I've gone. And Extreme Makeover is something that I never would have ever dreamed for myself. And so I've been very lucky so far to sort of letting life take me where it takes me. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of just willing to let that happen some more.
That's really a good skill set to develop because it's so easy as a protection measure to try to control, yeah, outcomes, to try to like really focus on that sort of if then mentality. If I get this, then I'll be happy. Mm-hmm. Or if this happens, then I'll be devastated, right, or whatever. And if you can really figure out how to move along with life, it's just, you're just going to be happier because, yeah, you're just not fighting it every step of the way. Do you want to do more films? Do you want to star another sitcom? Would you want to do a drama? Have you thought about, like, do you even think about stuff on that level?
You know, it's hard to think that far into the future because, I think I'll be busy for the next, like, at least year with the play and then Extreme Makeover. So
you're going to get offered stuff, though.
Listen, I mean, that's why I'm here, to please call 213. You know, I can't imagine jumping into another sitcom right away. I just feel like it's going to be very hard to top what Modern Family was and is. I love drama. I'm always looking to, like, I'm always looking for roles that feel very different than what I've been doing for the last 11 years. So I think it really depends on you know, the material. I mean, I'm in a very blessed place as an actor. There was a time where I really needed to take jobs that paid well, and I can kind of sit back and I don't really need to look at the money part of it is like the number one thing that I need to consider. I can sort of look at the material itself. So I haven't done a lot of film. It's something I would love to do. I just watched Marriage Story actually the other night, which is devastating, but I was like, that's it's such great acting and such great writing, and like there's just so many people I want to work with. So I'm excited to see what happens.
Do you want to direct? Would you direct plays?
Yeah. I think I would. I would. I was toying with the idea of directing an episode or two of Modern Family. Julie Bowen actually did. She's directed two, and she did such a great job. I'm just scared to direct that cast. I feel like I know them so well. I know what makes Ed O'Neill cranky. Like I don't want to deal with it. I just want to show up and let someone else tell me what to do. But I think if it was a different group of people that I wasn't so connected to, I would absolutely. I think I'd be good. I do think I'd be good.
I don't even think it would be that difficult for you to, if you wanted to like start directing a play. I'm sure someone would give you a play in like a half a second.
Well.
If you wanted to,
yeah.
I mean, it just seems like, you know, that could be. I mean, I know directing a play is totally different than directing television, but in a way, I guess you're still the master storyteller. Like at right. when you kind of rip it all away, the medium is different, but you still are trying to figure out how to tell a cohesive story.
I mean, it's something I haven't done. When I was young, I would direct these. Christmas pageants in my living room, and my siblings always thought I was very bossy, but they always loved doing them. And we, you know, we would like recreate the nativity scene and, you know, Catholic school,
of course.
And it always ended with, you know, the tree being plugged in, and that was the grand finale. And one year around Halloween, we started rehearsals for the Christmas show, and again, I was very bossy, and my siblings got upset with me and decided to quit. So
which you probably didn't realize was an option.
They walked out, which basically just meant they walked into their room and shut the door. And
during the Christmas pageant, or
no, this is the rehearsals in October,
Like,
you know, Halloween time.
Sure.
And so I stored the sets, and I was like, "We're not doing anything." The sets being, you know, like pieces of cardboard. And then Christmas break came along, and everyone was at home, and they were bored, and they're like, "Well, now we want to do the Christmas show again." So I said, "Okay, we can pull the sets out of storage and start production again." And I made them sign contracts.
Oh, you're in the right business.
So, you know, maybe I would be okay.
Now, did the contract state that they weren't allowed, like that they were exclusive to that production and that they couldn't just walk off?
I think it was basically like I, Kelly Ferguson or Ben Ferguson, say that we will not quit the show until after the show is finished. Sign here.
And at the time, they probably didn't realize, like, there was really no legal ramifications for them to break the contract.
They don't need to know that.
But they didn't need to know
that. Even to this day, that's like, they think that I still have ownership of them.
It's very possible you could just retroactively sue them for, the last, you know, whatever, 30 years not doing
the Christmas show.
You guys
didn't specify the term of the agreement.
Is it possible that for Christmas 2020, you could... As a joke, you should have your lawyer like draft up a real official version of it and send them that in the mail and say that you expect them for rehearsals, November 1st.
Exactly.
And that, you know, that you're going to do the Christmas.
That's a great idea.
That would be really fun.
I think I still have the sets, actually.
I think, you know what? I'm just spitballing an idea here. I bet, just for fun, you could go to Albuquerque and do like... a sort of more thorough version of your Christmas pageant as a charity show.
I 100%.
In Albuquerque with you and your brother and your sister in roles. But then
absolutely.
Like fully like cast it out. Just for fun.
I thought it was a great idea.
That's
actually.
Not a bad idea.
That's not a bad idea.
You could expand. You could take – and the set could sort of be like the old Ferguson living room.
Right.
Like, but on like the, you know, the stage of a theater
perfect.
In Albuquerque. And then actually just sort of do it as a
– It's perfect. It's a great idea.
The Ferguson Ferguson Christmas pageant.
It's Christmas Spectacular.
Christmas
no, that's Radio City already took that one.
God damn it.
God, they always steal everything.
Fuck. What about the Rockettes? No.
They're unavailable.
Son of a bitch. You can just hire some local Rockettes.
Yeah, exactly. Local Rockettes in Albuquerque. I'd love to see this.
Just like what there must be a local Rockette scene.
Well, I would hire the the spirit dancers from St. Pius X High School where I went.
Perfect.
The Dorados. They're called the Dorados.
Perfect, perfect. Is it a co-ed school now?
Yes, it is.
It is a co-ed school now, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what are you going to do for the, like, when you're done? Are you going to take a break? Are you going
to... Honestly, I have a week off. I'm meant to do jury duty.
Okay, good.
I think I'm going to postpone that. Because I go into rehearsal for the play the following week.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. The jury duty thing is, have you done it before?
I have.
Yeah. Where you show up and then you kind of wait for them to call you and then.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually love doing it. If I have the time to do it, I just have no time. And the last time I went in, I sort of gambled because I had to work. I was in production the following week and I thought, well, I'll go in. They're never going to choose me. They don't want some guy who's on Modern Family to be on the jury.
Right.
So I'll just show up. And I ended up getting chosen for jury selection. And they ended up keeping me for about 3 days for questioning. And I started to get nervous. Like, they might actually, you know, choose me. But
yeah, because if you have to work, they doesn't matter.
No, they don't care.
They say work is not an excuse to get on jury. So if you're like, I have to shoot next week, they're like, well, that's really bad for you then.
Yeah, exactly. And so but the funny thing was when we were going around and introducing, we had to say our names, like what we did for a living. And I said, you know, I'm Jesse, I'm an actor. And then like juror number seven was like, you know, I'm Kyle, I'm also an actor. And then he sort of said, not as successful as juror number three, but, you know, I'm also an actor. So like there was like titters and laughing. And,
sure.
And then later, a few days after that, they were saying, you know, this case may involve a CSI agent. And, you know, CSI agents in court are much different than, you know, CSI agents on television. Something mm-hmm. juror number three might know something about.
Oh, okay.
And so I said, you know what, I raised my hand, said, I just feel like we've sort of singled me out a few times here in the room. And I just feel even if this is how it's happening in the jury selection process, I'm just nervous about how it's going to go for this guy's trial. Like he should have a fair trial.
Sure. Feel
like this is not, we're not setting him up for a very fair
right.
juror. I don't think I should be on this jury.
Were you ever concerned at all that if you, like, in the sort of extreme case where they're like, oh my God, you're in some crazy murder trial as a juror.
Right.
And then the person on trial gets convicted and they look at you and go, I know who you are.
Yeah.
I'm going to track you down. You know, like, because you don't, you're not anonymous.
I haven't thought about that till just now.
Okay,
and
sorry.
Oh, shit.
Okay.
Terrified.
Well, I take it back. It'll be fine. No, it'll be totally fine. But it is a fascinating process. And actually, I really enjoyed, you know, I went downtown. And if you're mm-hmm. a juror, you get, at least at the time when I went, you get to take your jury badge and go to the museums.
Yeah.
Like, I went to the museums downtown.
Oh, yeah. The
like,
world
for
opens
lunch
up
break.
To you when you're a juror.
It's really.
Yeah. The Grand Central Market, they'll give you a free Coke.
It was a beautiful day. It was a beautiful day outside. Yeah. You know, it's like you're sitting in the room. There's internet in there. It's like, what do you, you know, like you're part of the system. Like it's not. It's
no,
it's
I liked it. Again, if I had the time, I'd be totally down for it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a good time.
It's not, guys. It's not, I have to be.
It's
I really,
not a good
I would
time.
Like to. I really like to. How many times have you had to go?
This is like my fourth or fifth time in the past like 7 years.
And do you feel like it's the jury system being like, we're gonna fucking get this guy on a jury?
Yeah, maybe. Possibly.
Because I feel like in sometimes they want to make examples out of the entertainment people to be
right.
like, you're not exempt.
Exactly.
And nor should
and
we
nor
be.
We should be.
No.
I do know that there was, I think it was Tom Hanks who's actually, he actually got chosen for a jury and he was serving. I think it was Tom Hanks. I'm not fully sure. But one of the lawyers was a fan and asked on one of the breaks if they could take a photo with Tom Hanks. And they took a photo and the whole case was dismissed because it was like one of the lawyers was showing favoritism to one of the jury members.
Oh, my God.
And they had to start over.
Oh,
and it's
my.
Like Tom Hanks. It's not his fault. Like he was just being nice. Like he didn't know what to do. So, you know, there is that too. Like I do think it, like having someone who's that recognizable on a jury does cause some complications, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know,
and I'm not comparing myself to Tom
no,
Hanks.
No. But you are very recognizable. In my case, I just sort of feel like, oh yeah, that guy's on TV.
Yeah, for sure.
So he's hosts an after show.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
I don't really feel like my presence would halt a trial, but
well. I think you underestimate your power.
No, I don't think. Yeah. I don't really think so. Your Honor, as a member of the entertainment business, sorry, you're a jury member. Objection.
Yeah.
Overruled. But that process. I mean, my wife and I watch so many investigation discovery shows.
Yeah.
It would be really interesting to sort of see what the other side of it is, to sort of see, like, you know, what does a jury of peers go through in order to arrive? Because when you watch these shows, or you watch like a docuseries about a trial or whatever, you're watching something that, you know, in theory could take several months in an hour or 42 minutes.
Right.
So there's a lot of gaps that are, you know, so you make judgments about things that you watch, but it's like, but what really, like, what was everything that happened?
Right.
You know, that part really interests me.
Right. And there are a lot of holes where nothing happened and they were just falling asleep and, you know, like waiting for someone to like come to their side and process.
It is a process.
So anyways, I have
is your husband a lawyer?
He is, and I thought that would disqualify me.
But no.
I don't know if it does.
Hmm.
And also I play a lawyer on TV, so I even tried to use that. I was like, but that really doesn't.
Is he a trial lawyer?
No.
Okay.
No, he's not. He works in nonprofit. So
if you do get on a jury though, I think you should lead everything with as a TV lawyer.
Yeah.
.. Just to see if that.
Yeah.
Because if you're on TV, that automatically people would think that you have some sort of legal
expertise. Right.
Lawyer on TV, so you must have a.
Yeah.
People forget that actors, you know, that it's a great game of pretend.
Yeah. Meanwhile, know nothing about it.
Well, I hope that. That you only get on selected for a jury when you're able to fit it into your schedule,
exactly.
Or when, you know, you're not going to be recognized by everyone on the trial. But are you going to take any breaks this summer? Are you going to take any trips, anything?
We just came back from Puerto Rico for New Year's Eve,
mm-hmm.
which was amazing. And when we shot an episode of Modern Family in Paris,
mm-hmm.
a few months ago, and we were able to take a little bit of vacation piggybacking on that. But I think they want to maybe do an – I mean, this is knock on wood, nothing's official, but like, you know, if Extreme Makeover does well this year, I think they might want to do more. So that would sort of put me right back into production right as soon as the play is done. So.
I feel like it's going to do well. Like when I saw the commercial for it, I said to my wife, like, oh my God, this is coming back.
Yeah.
You know, like we're excited. It just feels like the right combination of everything.
Yeah.
It's like the right time to bring it back. It's the right feel-good show. It's the right network.
Yeah. I'm very, very proud of it. I've seen all 10 episodes that we've shot and – I can't wait for people to see it and get to know these families. And I think it's going to be a really positive, wonderful thing that people get to turn to on television.
Not to turn this into not to take something beautiful and commercialize it, but I'm just saying, just noodle in the back of your head what the Jesse Tyler Ferguson home goods line looks like in your, you know, is it kitchen goods? Is it pillows? Is it furniture?
I mean, the world's my oyster.
It really kind of
you
is.
You know what? It's oysters. It's oysters. God, I don't know. I mean, I am actually the other thing why I can't take a break right now is I'm actually in the midst of writing a cookbook as well.
Oh, you are?
I am.
What kind of cookbook?
I'm working with my friend Julie, who's a chef, and she's from the South. She's from Alabama,
mm-hmm.
and I'm obviously from Albuquerque, New Mexico, as we've been discussing. And we're sort of drawing from the food that we grew up in, grew up eating, you know, me with lots of like Hatch green chili and, you know, tortillas and like a lot of spice in her with, you know, cornbread and sorghum and molasses. And actually these cuisines go very well together. So it's sort of it's more of a story of a friendship, but, told through recipes. And it's something that's very fun to work on. I'm not one who like sits down and writes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been very challenging for me. I think, you know, if there was maybe something to spin off onto, it would be like something in the culinary world.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do see those. I can see those cuisines going together, like Southwestern, like Poblano barbecue,
absolutely.
Like Southwestern, because the Southwestern is really like a nice filter in the South. Cause barbecue has so many different,
right.
Like the South is so. Like every part of the South is protective over its own cuisine.
Yeah.
And there's that sort of, you know, joke or maybe serious kind of like, well, that's Kansas City barbecue. This is Texas barbecue, which is different than Memphis barbecue, which is different than Alabama.
And actually, New Mexican food is much different than Mexican food. It's like, you know, we're also very territorial with our cuisine in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've been working on some really – I mean, it's not strictly – in those parameters. But that's sort of like the genesis of the idea. And then from there, we're like, you know, just creating really fantastic recipes that I think everyone's going to really like.
Do you like to meditatively cook?
I do. I find it very calming.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a cook?
No. I mean, I like the science aspect of it, yeah, where someone gives you a bunch of the ingredients and you have to sort of figure – it's sort of like turning science into art.
Right.
Like everyone gets the same recipe with the same amount of ingredients and it can turn out a million different ways. Yeah. And that's sort of the sort of the humanizing of the science or the art of the science.
Right.
My wife is just like naturally an amazing – she just loves to cook and she'll just like throw shit together and go, oh, I just tried to do – and it's amazing. Yeah. Like I don't feel like I have that sort of intuitive. I'll just throw a dash of this. Like, I need the very specific rule set. Some
guidelines, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, the cooking shows always make it easy, but it's like, yeah, someone has parsed out everything in tiny bowls.
Yeah.
And you throw it into...
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that part of it, that they call it mise en place, so like putting everything in place. And like, just that process of like, filling those tiny little bowls with the top things, it can take like an hour and a half.
Of course. And then the cleanup?
Yeah, and like here in Ina Gardens, just throwing it together in 10 minutes.
So you ask me if I like to cook. I like the part of it where
it's, where you get to eat.
Well, I like the eating part, but I like the part where you're just throwing shit in a pot.
Yeah.
The having to pull everything out, clean as you go along. Yeah. I spilled flour everywhere. Clean up after.
Yeah.
Like that's... I feel like that's the same thing. It's the same thing with stand-up and it's the same thing with acting where it's like all the prep work, the actual thing you do is what you spend the least amount of time doing.
Exactly. That's such an interesting way of looking at it. I've never thought about it that way.
Yeah, now, but yeah.
I'm going to be like, I have to go to rehearsal and I'm going to be like chopping onions.
God.
Rehearsing for the meal.
I'll be in my trailer. I'm
doing tech now. Like, yeah.
Who's going to chop the onions? Yeah. Isn't there a PA who can chop these onions? No, it's not really. You got to
I have actually asked someone to help me prepare. I was like, could you just do a little prep work for me?
Just a little bit.
My husband's terrible at it. He's like, I won't let him near the kitchen.
Oh, so he's not. He does not have that gene.
Useless.
He does not have the cook gene at all.
No.
But it sounds like if he's a lawyer, he's really good with like.
He's good at so many other things that I'm terrible at. Basically everything but cooking.
But that's probably why it's such a good marriage, because you guys complement each other. I can never tell if it's good to be amazing at the same things, because then it's like double amazingness, or if it's better where like everyone kind of has their own mutant powers.
I'm so happy he's better at like, I'm always handing him my phone saying, I don't know what happened.
That's my
wife. Yeah. All the time.
I'm going to get my wife a t-shirt that says, I don't know where the fuck I put my phone.
Yeah.
Because that's what I hear like several times, because she hates technology so much.
Too.
She almost subconsciously is, I think, losing it on purpose because she just doesn't want to fucking be near it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you have the kind of relationship where your husband is immediately on top of texts and emails and yours has like a crazy red dot with like a big number on it because they are unanswered?
I look at them, but then I don't answer them.
Gotcha,
like I don't
gotcha,
like
gotcha.
See – I'm crazy enough that I don't want to see the red dot.
Yeah.
I need the red dot to be gone.
Yeah.
But I'm not necessarily going to respond to them. So the stuff gets buried and I don't answer them. And he is a rapid texter.
Mm-hmm.
So if like I'm not near my phone, like because I text him and he responds to me immediately.
Yeah.
And if I will leave my phone in another room for hours. And like,
are you doing?
He shows up out of breath. He's like, I thought you were dead. I'm like, no, I'm fine. I'm watching Succession. Calm down. Like,
I totally know what you're
I'm totally fine. Shiv's in a situation. Like, I gotta finish this.
I've done that with Lydia before. And then in the aftermath, I'm like, oh no, I'm the asshole because not everyone has their phone attached to their leg at all times. But she has no fear of the red dot whatsoever.
One time Justin left his phone at home. We were on vacation and we were out for the entire day. And he's like, oh crap, I think I left my phone at the hotel. And he shares his location with me. So I checked. I was like, yep, it's at the hotel. I was like, so you don't have it for 8 hours. You're going to be fine. And at the end of the day, you would have thought he was expecting a parade in the honor of his bravery. Like
he's the real hero.
He marched to his phone. He was like, I'm back. And like, just, I mean, he couldn't stop talking about how amazing it was that he had left his phone at home all day.
And literally it was just like a day. Yeah, it was like half a day. But, you know, it is, you know, we with our our significant others, we do need to like praise their victories. Yes. Good for you.
Yes.
I know that was very hard for you.
It was very hard for
tomorrow. Let's try for 9 hours instead of 8 and
never
see
happened.
If we can. No, it'll never
happen.
Well, it sucks when you have a, it's just because it's so tied not only to our personal lives, but our professional lives.
Yeah.
And so
true.
It's funny to me, like in Mad Men days, like the office was the office and home was home.
Yeah.
And now everything is everything because you have your fucking office in your pocket and your entire personal connections as well.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's important to sort of take forcible technology breaks?
Yes. Yeah, so I literally, it's so funny you just said that because I guess it's my New Year's resolution. I deleted Instagram and Twitter from my phone.
Yep.
They still exist. And Justin, my husband, has access to them. So like he's actually posting things for me, you know, throughout the month. But like I love not having that as an option.
Yeah.
You know, I had an alert last month about my screen time. And I was like, that's absolutely unacceptable. The things I could have done in that time.
When you add up the hours, it's you fucking add up horrifying. The hours,
it's horrifying. So I was like, I got to get that down. Also, I'm just stressed out with like writing a book and like, you know, there's so many things happening. I was like, the one thing I don't need is that I don't need to check Instagram because that would be the thing I would do to like calm myself down or I give myself a break. I was like, I have to learn to play. I have other things to do.
Well, yes, because that's the distraction from the stress of all the other
shit
and the avoidance.
But then for some reason, it gives me more stress.
Of course it does. Because you can't, our brains literally cannot process the amount of information that we're trying to shove in them at all times.
No.
It's just like, you look at stuff on your phone and it's all like, most of it, I think, just either bounces off your ear or just kind of sails out the other side.
Yeah.
But it's still, it sort of creates like the skid marks on your soul along the way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you still feel like the impact of it, even if you're not retaining any information. Like it's in 50 years or 100 years, they're going to look back and go, what were these fucking morons doing?
What were
these people doing?
I know.
Yeah. Why were, it's like, what, we look back and like, why did they have mercury in glass? Like, why was lead in glass?
Yeah, yeah,
what the fuck were these people thinking?
Yeah.
That's
our Instagram.
Instagram, like social media is lead in glass, basically, in 50 years, I would imagine.
But it's also a great tool. You know, it's a double-edged sword.
It is. It's like anything. It's like, you know, anything can be used positively or negatively. And if you, you know, but just unfortunately, a lot of times people can't have nice things.
Yeah, yeah.
And things get misused.
Right.
But, you know, in general, everything, you know, it should be all good.
Yeah.
But what are you, just as we're wrapping this up, what are you joyful about in your world right now?
Oh, gosh. I've been talking about how busy I am, but I think that's something that I'm actually really, really, really happy with. I mean, I love having a full calendar. I like, you know, I don't know if you've watched that Joan Rivers documentary and she's like,
oh my God, a piece of
flipping,
work.
Yeah.
Yes.
She flips through her calendar and she goes, this is my biggest fear. And it's a month where there's nothing on the page.
Yeah.
And while I was watching, I was like, God, that seems like my biggest dream right now. But like, truly, I feel like having a purpose and having something to do and having something to be responsible for, I think, is something I'm actually really grateful for, and it's making me very happy. I sometimes wish I had more free time, but that I'm getting to do things that I love doing, and I have things that I'm looking forward to this year. It makes me very, very happy, and I have, you know, a healthy family and a great marriage, and you know, these are all things that I wished for 11 years ago, and I'm thrilled that as the series is wrapping up, that I have it more so than ever.
And do you feel, because I imagine you know how the show ends.
I don't know if I do.
Oh, actually. You don't? Really?
I kind of have an idea of where it might be heading, but yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing that you don't quite know yet.
Yeah.
And you're four episodes out.
Four episodes out.
The Joan Rivers thing, I have such mixed, I knew Joan and I adored her, and and you know, if she hadn't passed away in such an unnatural way, I feel like she'd still be on stage.
1,000%.
And so I have a real struggle with just for how I kind of view things for myself personally, because I totally get the, you know, if I'm not working all the time, do I exist thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's entirely healthy to that degree, but at the same time, it kept her so active,
so vital,
and vital and vibrant and young, because she was so curious and because she craved engagement and that had that curiosity. that it, you know, as opposed to like if she was just someone who is like, oh, you know, at 55 I was in my pajamas every day, and then she would have turned into an old person real fast. Absolutely. It kept her young. And so I just have a real I don't know.
But I look at her and she's someone who I admired so greatly, and I did get to know her a little bit in her last few years, and I just look, she's a role model, and I look at why she was as successful as she was and as vibrant as she was at her age. And I think you're absolutely right. I think it's because she kept herself busy and relevant. And that was her doing. I mean, mm-hmm. she kept herself.
Through so many ups and downs. So many points in her career where people were like, you're done. And she's like, fuck you, I'm not. And just wrote it out and pulled it off. Absolutely. You know, every time.
Yeah.
But it also shows you that given enough time, there's going to be like a sine wave of ups and downs in it, but if you can just sort of stay in the game the whole time, you know, it nets out.
No, she was sort of like looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah.
But
I just worry about like, you know, that sort of relationship to work where it's like you rely so much on that to sort of feel like you exist.
I never want it to define me, but I want it. I like that I have it there to keep me busy and to I mean, give me opportunity. I feel like work keeps me creative mm-hmm. in a way that I think I'm not always feeling creative. I think I can definitely settle into wanting to just stay home and open a bottle of wine and watch TV. And I think I don't fire on all my synapses when I sit like that for too long. So.
No, being sedentary is the word. Yeah. You're just like your brain, the gears stop and they start to rust. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You come back from vacation and you just have to get back into work mode. And you're like, oh, that's right. Oh yeah, I got to be on. You know, everything's got to start again. But yeah, I miss her. I adored her so much. Do you fucking believe that in her mid to late 70s, she was flying to L.A. every fucking week to do Fashion Police?
Yeah.
Because she just wanted to live in New York.
Yeah.
So she'd fly back and forth every week and was so nice to everyone. God damn it.
I know. It was really unfortunate. I actually went to her shiva, and we were shooting Modern Family in the Palisades, and she and Melissa live very close mm-hmm. to the Palisades. So I had about two hours off from work, and I said, I'm going to go over to a friend's shiva. It's like 5 minutes away. I'll be back in like, you know, 45 minutes. So I get to the house and Melissa greets me at the door, and I you know, the Kathy Griffin's there and like her whole family's there. And it was full of all these people who loved her. And it was I get a text from Modern Family saying, we actually pushed your scene. We need you back in like 15 minutes. I was like, great, I'm going to go. It's 5 minutes away. So I get up to go. And right as I'm getting up to leave, the rabbi stands up at the front door and starts speaking about Joan Rivers. Oh. And it's the only exit.
Oh.
And so Kathy Griffin is standing next to me. I'm showing her the text. And she goes, oh, my God, this is fucking hilarious. This is Joan Rivers literally playing jokes. Fucking with you right now. And she's like helping me try and find a back entrance. Like nothing. So I'm texting Modern Family in a frenzy. Like, I'm stuck at a shiva. I'm trapped at the shiva. I'm trapped at Joan Rivers shiva.
Can someone give this guy the light?
Yeah.
This guy, give him the light.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll wrap up. Okay, I'll wrap up the shiva. That's really sweet, though. I'm glad you were able to go experience that. I I've run into you at events a handful of times, and I don't think we've ever really had a lengthy conversation, but
it's hard at those.
It is really hard. It's always loud, and it's like, you, especially when you don't really know people, you're like, how do I know what to ask about?
Exactly.
It's nice enough just to say hi, but I have to say, you've always made me feel like I already knew you.
That's nice.
I would say to Lydia, like, I feel like an asshole. Like, have I hung out with him before and I didn't, and I don't remember? Like, what's wrong? Because you're just always like, hey, man, how's it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's a party, some party last year that I ran into and you just, I don't know. There's just a friendly familiarity that I always really appreciated. And so it's sort of in those situations where I've always automatically just felt kind of wildly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
There are a handful of people that if I see and you're one of them, like, oh, I feel like I feel okay.
Oh, I love that you said that.
If he's here, I feel okay.
That's very sweet to say, because I'm always looking for those people myself. So
the anchors, they're like the little buoys in this sort of weird, and it's all like self-generated. Like, those 100%. Things are what they are, but it is just sort of nice to feel like, oh, okay, all right.
Yeah.
There's some people here. I can. You can always tell, like, all the comedians will muster over in one corner.
Yeah.
You know, and just be.
You can always count on me to be that.
I appreciate that.
I'll be your lighthouse.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, Jesse. Thank you for being here. Is there anything else you want to promote? Do you want to promote any of the activist work you're doing?
Tie the Knot is a foundation that me and my husband started.
Oh, with Tie Bar, right?
Yeah, with the Tie Bar, exactly. Yeah. And we started it initially to work toward marriage equality. When we started, there was about, I think, 10 or 11 states in the United States that had marriage equality. And we were basically just selling bow ties, and all the proceeds from the bow ties came to Tie the Knot. And we, in turn, gave them to organizations that were in the trenches fighting for marriage equality. And then, you know, we won marriage equality about 7 years ago. And now we're continuing to raise money to just protect those rights that we fought so hard for. So Tie the Knot is our foundation, and it's going really strong. We've raised almost over $1 million to date just on the sale of bow ties.
That's fantastic. And by the way, a bow tie is a good investment.
It is. Everyone needs a bow tie.
Everyone needs a bow tie. Bow ties are great because they can be super formal or they can still be casual at the same time.
Yeah.
It's a good accessory. So everyone should support marriage equality. They should support Tie the Knot and just support bow ties in
general. Just support bow ties in general. And I have a bow tie tutorial online. You could watch it. It's more comedy driven, but it's still very useful.
Still never been able to tie a bow tie on my own.
Watch my tutorial.
I will do it. Thank you so much. The
All
end.
Right, thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
I feel like I was blindsided.
Because it's a competition show.
From the producers of Jury Duty and The Bachelor.
We have scoured the earth for the 14 greatest reality contestants that were available during our production window.
Comes a reality competition show about reality competition shows.
Nobody has dared to find out who is the actual best at just being on a reality show. I'm your host, comedian Daniel Tosh.
Is win or go home.
Each episode, our contestants will face new challenges that will test their strength and lack of life skills for a chance to win $200
million.
$200,000.
Prepare, because it's about to be ugly, crying,
lots of fighting.
Tayshia, I have to defend myself.
Celebrating 25 years of reality TV with your favorites.
I have diarrhea. You cannot do this to me.
What in gay hell have I got myself into?
The GOAT, premiering on Freevee and Prime Video on May 9th.